Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. On this episode, we'll feature an interview with Paul DiRica of the Pocket Guide to Hell Tours and Reenactments, talking about the lesser-known dimensions of Chicago's history. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But first, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Last week, NPR made the personnel decision heard round the world, or at least the cable news networks, when they fired news analyst Juan Williams after he made controversial remarks about Muslims on Fox News. It didn't take long for a handful of politicians and commentators to seize on Williams' dismissal as an opportunity to attack all federal funding for public media outlets. But Josh Silver, president of Free Press, says that what public media really needs right now is defending, not defunding.
Regardless of how you feel about whether NPR was justified in firing Juan Williams or not, the problem is calling for the full defunding of public media across the board, radio, television, community media, is absurd. It's like calling for the death penalty in small claims court.
In fact, the United States already has one of the worst funded public media systems in the world, spending only $1.43 per capita, while countries like Denmark and Finland spend upwards of $100 per person.
They call for the defunding of the system when, ironically, the need for public media funding has never been greater. We're seeing newsrooms being shuttered across the country and around the world. We're seeing newspaper staff being cut en masse as the revenue that used to go to classified ads moves to the internet. And we're seeing commercial and radio and television journalism becoming a bit of an oxymoron. You see virtually no investigative reporting of substance on radio and television.
Detractors insist that NPR and PBS programming are a waste of taxpayer dollars. But studies have shown that the public feels otherwise.
If you look at poll after poll, public media in the United States is the single most trusted brand of media. Not only that, it's one of the most trusted institutions in America, following the military as a worthy place to spend public money. So the discourse you're seeing is completely out of context with how the American public really feels, and they view it as an incredibly worthy place to put public money.
Silver insists that instead of slashing funds, the opposite is needed, a dramatic reinvestment in public media.
And if we can do that, if we can create a system that is more like the successful models in other countries, we stand a chance of fostering the kind of critical journalism that this country so desperately needs.
Last week, members of the disability community in the Bay Area spoke out for net neutrality and called for the Federal Communications Commission to protect the open internet. Their letter to the FCC is a direct response to anti-net neutrality comments made in January by the World Institute on Disability. The institute told the FCC that net neutrality regulations would negatively impact people with disabilities. AT&T's public policy director chairs the World Institute's board. Ruth Ann Spinner, who helped coordinate the letter with the nonprofit organization Media Alliance, wanted to give voice to a different contingent in the disability community who believe the open internet is vital to their lives and livelihoods. Spinner, who is disabled from a spinal cord injury, uses the internet on a daily basis to help maintain her independence.
People with disabilities, like everyone else, but perhaps more so, have come to be really dependent on the internet and internet connections I know I personally have used Craigslist for finding attendant care because it's the quickest way to post an ad for I need help X number of days and I'm paying this amount of money, call me at Y time, and then you can get lots of responses.
The open internet also allows disabled workers to work remotely or even start their own businesses. Spinner said this is especially important for a population with such a high unemployment rate, 14.8%, compared to 9% for people with no disabilities.
If they are homebound by their disability, lots of people I know are conducting their business out of their home because they can do it from their computer.
To find out more information, visit media-alliance.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
COINTELPRO 101, the latest film release from the Freedom Archives, is nothing like the all-too-common soft, liberal documentary, which tells of worse and distant horrors so as to lessen the pain or awareness of those still occurring. It is not a film that imposes a happy ending by suggesting that its subject is somehow past. It is a film that makes plain the fact that all of your problems today, from war to incarceration to banking crises, joblessness, and environmental catastrophe, still exist because movements to do away with them suffered and continue to suffer the greatest levels of repression from the most powerful state apparatus in world history. And worse still, as Black Panther Party veteran Kathleen Cleaver states unequivocally, unlike the official counterintelligence program of previous decades, today's version is perfectly legal. COINTELPRO 101 is just that. It is an introduction to the often omitted history of the FBI's illegal wars of terror waged against the full spectrum of radical left movements in this country. The counterintelligence program, which emerged in the post-World War II era of international struggles for human rights and national liberation, simply focused internally to the United States all that had been carried out against populations abroad. It turned so-called U.S. citizens in the 20th century into insurgent rebels to be dealt with as any foreign army or movement. Assassination, imprisonment, surveillance, and encouraged internal strife were employed to forcibly dissolve these movements. But, as this film so skillfully demonstrates, this all was merely an extension of a continuing state project of enslavement, genocide, theft of land, culture, and humanity that predates even the official declaration of U.S. nationhood. The film's brilliance is not simply its nicely styled aesthetic elements. They are there, of course. Strong interviews, rarely seen clips, high-quality audio and video production across the board, with equally strong narration from Liz Darius. But it's the film's ability to force new confrontation with the political reality of today as much as with the past that truly demonstrates its value. The simple point made by Geronimo Pratt is also its strongest. That COINTELPRO made official the illegality of politics, the criminalization of positions represented by its targets. COINTELPRO was the political and legal descendant of its ancestors' slavery and genocide, and is now itself an ancestor to the still implemented policies of, for instance, the Patriot Act. This central theme of the film is its most important because it forces us to put in context the current and horrific state of peace, freedom, and labor movements. As COINTELPRO 101 makes vividly clear, the black misleadership class, described so often in the pages of Black Agenda Report, is the result of having first destroyed the rightfully ascending black leadership class of that time. This film helps reestablish lost cognition imposed by popular anti-histories, which allow for so many to falsely assume that Obama is a natural progression from civil rights and black power movements. The film inserts stolen pages of history that result in an assumption that Native America went willingly to the reservations and then happily stayed there, having never attempted movements to protect whatever remaining autonomy they might have had. No one who sees this film can return to conventional and now popularly re-emerging arguments over immigration or human illegality. In fact, COINTELPRO 101 goes further than most histories of this phenomenon, reminding us of the threats posed by the Puerto Rican and Chicano independence movements. One can only imagine with a kind of hope what these discussions would sound like were they to take place in this film's context of state repression and specifically the killing of Chicano movement activists like Ricardo Falcón. Indeed, would these arguments even exist without first the assault on these movements and their representatives? COINTELPRO 101 is the latest in an increasingly long line of collected, preserved, and produced media from the Freedom Archives, which seeks to appropriately tell the stories of diverse but unified efforts towards liberation. It powerfully summarizes the continued need of those in power to suppress and, in their own words, neutralize movements and individuals so that more acceptable replacements could be developed and promoted. For if, as the film asserts, the continued imprisonment of people like American Indian Movement activist Leonard Peltier is a symbol to, through discouragement, protect the state from further similar activity, then what do popular, sanctioned, and elected leaders of today represent? For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Jared Ball. Online, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. We now feature an interview with Paul DiRica of the Pocket Guide to Hell Tours and Reenactments, talking about the lesser-known dimensions of Chicago's history. The following interview was recorded on Monday, October 18th, 2010. We are joined on the phone by Paul DiRica. Paul DiRica is the founder and proprietor of the Pocket Guide to Hell Tours and Reenactments Project, and he is joining us on the phone from Chicago. Paul, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here. It's great to talk to you.
Good to talk with you as well. For listeners who may be unfamiliar with the Pocket Guide to Hell Tours and Reenactments Project, please give a little bit of background of what it is.
Sure. So back in 2008, while I was in the midst of beginning work on a dissertation project, I decided that I wanted to do something that would take the information that I was looking at and allow me to share it in a more kind of direct and immediate way and with a kind of larger and more general public. So I was doing work in Chicago, and I'm interested in narratives that deal with various social justice issues, labor history, and even a little bit of true crime, basically in the second part of the 19th century and the first part of the 20th century. And so I decided that I would start giving walking tours. The name Pocket Guide to Hell derives from a quotation by John Burns, who was an English labor leader who visited Chicago supposedly in the early 1900s. And Jack London relates this anecdote that Burns apparently, upon arriving in Chicago, was asked what he thought about the city. He kind of surveyed the sort of political situation, the sort of like working conditions of most people, all the sort of industrial work going on. And he said that Chicago is a pocket edition of hell. A week later, the journalist who had interviewed him wanted to see if having spent time in the city, Burns had reassessed his opinion. And Burns said, yes, I now believe that hell is a pocket edition of Chicago. And so that's what the name comes from, and that's kind of the sort of spirit behind the tours. So far, I've done a Leopold and Loeb tour. I've done something I call the Working Man's Guide to the World's Columbian Exposition, which was a tour of Jackson Park, but focused on the people who built the World's Columbian Exposition and sort of what happened to them and in the neighborhood, both during and after the World's Fair. I've done something called the Secret History of the University of Chicago, which looks at the first decade or so of that institution's history. I've done a Haymarket tour, and most recently I've done something called Ben Reitman's Hobohemia. And then I've done a couple reenactments, including last May, one of the 1877 Battle of the Halsted Viaduct, which was a clash between striking railway and meatpacking workers in Bridgeport and Pilsen and Chicago police and federal troops. And it was part of a kind of nationwide strike that occurred that summer in 1877. So that's kind of what I'm doing. I'm taking sort of some narratives that are well-known in Chicago's history, some that are less well-known, and kind of playing around with existing ways of kind of telling stories about the past, either using the form of the walking tour or the historical reenactment, or in some cases I'll give lectures with like sort of transparencies and give them a sort of kind of more sort of old-timey feel. So that's what I've been up to, at least since 2008.
I was very lucky to have recently attended one of these tours, that for the tour that you had described called Ben Reitman's Hobohemia. This was a tour that took place in Chicago along the corridor of Madison Street, which, if you visit it today, is a fairly upscale and clean place.
But once upon a time, in fact, not all that long ago, it was not the case. And I was wondering if you could describe a little bit more about what the tour Hobohemia is, what Hobohemia itself was, and I guess a little bit of the history regarding Madison Street in Chicago.
Sure. Okay. Well, the word Hobohemia was coined by sociologists to describe the sort of part of a city where transient, primarily transient men would gather. And this area would have employment agencies, it would have barrel house saloons, cheap lodging houses and flop houses, burlesque and vaudeville theaters, cheap restaurants, secondhand clothing stores, basically everything that a sort of migrant laborer or seasonal laborer would require when wintering in a city. Oftentimes they'd be close to railway lines, and this was certainly the case in Chicago. Chicago had more railway lines within the city limits than certain countries in Europe, and this is at the end of the 19th century. So places like Holland and Portugal, like Chicago itself, had more train lines than whole countries. And this brought a lot of sort of like transient labor into the city. Most of them were taking rides on trains illegally. They'd be working in the summer and spring, and then they would come back in the late autumn and in winter and hole up in Chicago. So the population along West Madison Street, which is where most of the stuff was centered, varied from about 30,000 people in the sort of summer and spring months to anywhere from 75,000 to 100,000 people in the sort of winter months. And then sociologists at the University of Chicago and Northwestern became fascinated by this area, just as they were sort of fascinated by the city at large, and began to sort of send their graduate students into these areas to study them. And one graduate student from the University of Chicago was a guy named Nels Anderson, who spent most of 1922 living on West Madison Street, interviewed and wrote case studies of over 400 transients, and then produced a study which was published in 1923 called The Hobo, The Sociology of the Homeless Man. He got a lot of information from a guy named Ben Reitman, who was a physician and a kind of amateur sociologist, and he was probably remembered today for having also been a longtime lover and companion to Emma Goldman, and was basically sort of Emma Goldman's PR person for about 10 years, between like 1908 and 1917, 1918. Reitman himself would take people on tours of West Madison Street. So this is the first tour that I've done, and in some ways is kind of replicating a tour that somebody in Chicago could have gone on in, say, like the late 19-teens. And Reitman did it all the way up through the early 30s. And sometimes he took academics on these tours. Sometimes he took social reformers. Other times he would just take members of the general public. And so it's interesting to try to kind of recreate a kind of older experience and follow a route that's been traced before, but to do it, you know, since Reitman stopped doing it, you know, in the 30s, you know, 80 years later, and the way in which the neighborhood has been completely transformed. So nothing of the sort of story that Reitman was telling is really left there anymore. And it's part of what makes, I think, the tour interesting for me to do, is to see the ways in which this sort of history has been just kind of completely effaced and erased. Because as you said, the Hobohemian neighborhood, which was known as the main drag or the main stem, is now called Westtown, and is a very sort of upper middle class neighborhood with all the sort of amenities that you expect that neighborhood to have.
In the course of doing these tours, in the time that you've done them, you've mm-hmm. no doubt been able to, at least I would imagine that you've had some measure of outreach to people who might not know otherwise. Could you assess for me what you think has been the relative success as far as the goal in these tours and reenactments and historical events that you've been pursuing?
Sure. So one thing that I'm interested in doing with these walking tours is making them accessible and also relatively like open and also cheap. So a lot of the sort of various tours that somebody can take in the city, they cost anywhere from $20 to $40. Oftentimes they involve getting people on a bus or maybe a Segway and kind of moving them very quickly through an area. So like you'll be on a bus, you'll stop at a place, maybe you'll get off for like 10 minutes and then you'll get back on the bus and head to the next spot. So I wanted the sort of things that I were doing to all take place, I mean, each one to take place in a single neighborhood and to actually kind of get people out on the street so that they kind of move through that space. I tried to like, you know, appeal to a kind of broad audience. So it's nice that on the tours I've been able to get families with their kids. I've been able to get older people. I've been able to get people in their 20s and 30s. I get people who are artists, people who are like labor historians, a whole kind of like mix, which is good. And most of them are from Chicago, which is the other thing that's like important to me. So a lot of the tours that are occurring here are geared towards tourists or people just kind of passing through the city. And so I'm really interested in kind of doing tours that are designed for people who live here and you kind of want to know more about the sort of history of their neighborhoods or the history of the spaces that they're going through. And as I said, a lot of the things that I'm talking about, the city, either deliberately or just through kind of natural processes, has done like a really great job of erasing. So most people don't know that there was like this large armed skirmish that occurred at 16th and Halsted. And why would they today? I mean, now it's like very close to like UIC. Or they don't know about the Hobohemia area. Or, you know, up until that Mary Broger statue commemorated the Haymarket affair, a lot of people didn't know about that, even though Haymarket is sort of the origin of May Day, which is basically the sort of Labor Day, almost the world round, I mean, apart from the United States. So in some ways, I've been trying to like take a sort of familiar form, the walking tour, but approach it in a different way to make it appealing to people who really kind of want to know more about the city in which they live. And I also try to pick themes that resonate with kind of contemporary issues. So clearly we're in the midst of a kind of economic crisis. And then so talking about, you know, past recessions and then depressions and how people living in the city cope with them, I think is, you know, of interest of me, to me at least, and it seems to be of interest to other people as well.
One of the tours that you had mentioned, and I'd like you to describe this and elaborate it on, is especially since this program will air on the University of Chicago's own radio station, The Secret History of the University of Chicago. Tell us, please, a little bit more about this.
Okay, well, on that tour, I sort of give it in the persona of Thorsten Veblen, who wrote The Theory of the Leisure Class. And so I basically kind of look at the sort of origins of the institution and the way in which the university, even though it has, it's, you know, it's characterized by its Gothic architecture, is very much the result of kind of late 19th century thought and values. And then if you look at it, you can also kind of see it replicating sort of the sort of economic history of the city. So most of the buildings were funded by the various kind of merchant princes in the city and represent all the different sort of, whose wealth represents all the different sort of like sources of wealth that existed at that time. So lumber, wholesale, grain. There was even a meat packer, Sidney Kent, who endowed a building. And then, of course, the university itself was founded by John D. Rockefeller of Standard Oil. So I kind of look at the intersection between sort of big business and you know, trusts and monopolies, and how the first president of the university, William Rainey Harper, attempted to still kind of create a sort of objective and impartial institution of higher learning. And then sort of points in the early history where those sort of scholarly values were challenged by the people who were more or less funding the university. So I talk about the university in relation to, say, the Pullman strike, which occurred in 1894. And I look at other early figures like John Dewey, who's very important. And I also look at like early student life. So there was a kind of sort of pioneer spirit in the university, and the students and the early faculty collaborated on creating a particular culture there and creating certain traditions. And so I resurrect a lot of those traditions, and I learned about them through reading early yearbooks, reading the first issues of The Maroon, by looking through lots of people's like scrapbooks and diaries. The Reichenstein has a great collection of things. And so there were all these like superstitions and songs and sort of other sort of aspects of student life that I was able to kind of incorporate into the tour. And kind of like the Hobohemia tour, I also drew on like old guidebooks to the university to give a sense of like what people in the late 19th century or the early 20th century thought were particularly interesting aspects of the campus, which maybe somebody taking a tour today wouldn't be aware of or wouldn't be mentioned. So, yeah, that's kind of what I talk about a little bit on that. There's a 1894 portrait of John D. Rockefeller that hangs in the Student Union. And what a lot of people don't know is that that portrait originally hung in the chapel, which was located in Cobb Hall, the first building on the university. And students were required to go to chapel service every day, as were members of the faculty. And so it was odd that when they went to the chapel, they didn't say, see an altar with some sort of cross, a crucifix or something, but instead there was a portrait there of a university's benefactor, John D. Rockefeller. So that's a little tidbit that's been sort of lost over time.
I find it fascinating that in your talking about these, I guess, hidden nuggets of history that kind of encompass the landscape of the city of Chicago, that it at least it kind of seems to me that I kind of find myself asking the question, what would things be like in maybe 100 years from now, where, you know, future historians might be talking about how things were in the present day and pointing to various efforts or things going on now. Tell us a little bit about, I guess it's kind of hard to tell exactly where the future may lie, but tell us some of the ways in which you think that the work in this history of sense kind of connect with not only contemporary themes, but also with where we may be going.
Well, on one hand, I really do wonder what sort of materials the future historian is going to draw upon. So in preparing a lot of these tours, I do a lot of primary source research. Unfortunately, the late 19th century produced a great deal of documentation. There was tons of sort of printed material. And as I said, like, I look at newspapers, I look at magazines from the period, but I look at people's personal papers and scrapbooks and all sorts of different things and lots of different like pieces of ephemera. And now, I mean, so much of the stuff that we produce or the material that we produce occurs in a digital form. And so it'll be curious to see like just how these kind of records survive. I mean, are future historians going to be like reading through the emails of like, you know, Mayor Daley? I don't know, but I presume that's the sort of stuff that people are going to have to do. And how's that information going to be accessible, and how's it going to be preserved? And so that's a whole kind of slew of problems for future historians. In terms of how the past in some ways resonates with the present and then perhaps, you know, provides one path to the future, I mean, I think what's interesting is that, I mean, we kind of see things shifting a little bit, right? So slowly but surely, there's a move away from like suburbs and exurbs and back into the city. And even though it's not necessarily reflected in population patterns, it seems like this is starting to happen. And on the Hobohemia tour, I talked about the kind of growth of poverty at an accelerated rate in the suburbs than in the cities. So as resources, you know, continue to dwindle and whatever else happens, climate change and economic shifts, I expect at least that cities will get denser again. And so some of the sort of, in some ways, you'll possibly begin to resemble kind of 19th centuries more in terms of this sort of intensity. And so perhaps kind of like looking at that sort of point in history and the ways in which people dealt with some of the kind of issues that arose from having a kind of dense, highly populated city will kind of help to think of kind of strategies moving forward. The other thing that seems really interesting about looking at this period is the degree to which people from all sorts of backgrounds seem very engaged in kind of social and political issues, right? So there were always kind of like marches and strikes and rallies and meetings and other things going on. And it's not to say that that doesn't happen still today in the city, but it definitely seems like the scale has changed. Not as many people are involved. And it seems like the only way that you can get hundreds of people out to are through spectacles and entertainment. And that's not always the case. And it depends on the issue. But I definitely think that, you know, looking at the ways in which people from the 19th century kind of engaged the problems that confronted them and kind of worked collectively in a lot of instances to address them, I think provides an interesting model. And that's something that we'll probably be returning to more and more as it seems like some of the similar problems, particularly the economic ones, will arise again. I mean, it's not far-fetched to say that our contemporary moment seems to be resembling the kind of Gilded Age more and more. People don't believe in political institutions anymore. They seem hopelessly corrupt. And, you know, the economic situation is a very kind of precarious one. So.
I guess a final question for people listening who would want to learn more about the tours that you give, about Pocket Guide to Hell tours and reenactments generally, or would like to go on a tour. How can they find out about it? How can they contact you?
Sure. There's two ways to do it. You could go to pocketguidetohell, it's all one word, @gmail.com. And then if you send me an email, you'll get added to the mailing list. If you're on Facebook and you friend Ben Reitman, you'll also receive information that way. Normally, whenever I do an event, there's also a listing in print as well. So oftentimes I'll have a listing in Time Out or The Reader. So that's another great way. And as I said, like, I like the tours. All the tours are free, although I do take donations. All of them are interactive, so participants will often be asked to perform some sort of role on the tour, and they normally last around 2 hours and happen on Sundays, so Sunday afternoons. But yeah, email is probably the mailing list is the best way to stay informed. So, but yeah.
We've been speaking with Paul Durica. He is the founder and proprietor of Pocket Guide to Hell Tours and Reenactments, talking to us about some little-known and sometimes ignored aspects of the history of Chicago and history of hidden aspects of Chicago. And he's been speaking with us over the phone about these issues. Paul, thank you so much again.
Thanks, Mitchell. It was great.
That was Paul Durica of the Pocket Guide to Hell Tours and Reenactments, accessible via email at pocketguidetohell@gmail.com. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.